On the Bookshelf with your host, Dave Doc Kirby.
One of the hot topics that's being debated, not just in the United States, although particularly here, but in lots of parts of the world, is the concept of multiculturalism, which has said to be the new version of what we're supposed to do in countries instead of the old paradigm of the melting pot. To talk to us about that today is Jens Heike. Was educated in economics and Near Eastern studies at the University of Chicago, the London School of Economics, and Princeton. Worked as an early employee or executive in several successful technology startups. Since retiring from tech, he has worked as a writer and researcher, conducting field research in more than 40 countries, from Bosnia to Botswana. Recently won a bronze medal at the World Masters Games as an internationally competitive masters cyclist, and he has topped places in other world championship events. His new book is Out of the Melting Pot into the Fire, Multiculturalism in the World's Past and America's Future, from Encounter Books. And you can check them out at encounterbooks.com, on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Jens, thank you so much. It's been kind of an interesting thing for us to finally get together, but I'm glad we're finally getting to do that.
Yeah, me too, Doc. Thanks so much for having me on.
One of the things that I found particularly interesting about your book are the examples that you have gathered from ancient history as well as modern history about civilizations that chose to go the multiculturalism route and those that have chosen to do the melting pot. Do you want to explain the terms a little bit for us?
The melting pot concept is really about different groups with different ethnic backgrounds coming together and melding together and sort of forging a shared culture, a shared identity. People are often mistaken about this, and the American melting pot has been characterized as a sort of paradigm where people have to give up all of their background and forget about where they came from. And that's never really been what it's about. It's really about coming together and sharing things. You don't forget where you came from. You don't abandon your heritage, but instead you kind of look forward and form a shared culture with the other people in your country. The multicultural paradigm, by contrast, is this idea where people come to a country like America and they really retain their identities and their entirety. They remain whatever they were when they first came instead of forging this sort of shared identity.
The idea of the melting pot has really come under fire recently because we've been told that's not really fair to the indigenous people. It's not fair to the immigrants. Why should they be forced to give up everything? And I certainly see some points that are made there. It seems to have worked awfully well for America, though not perfectly, of course, but it seems to work really pretty well. That is the melting pot an outdated thing? Is it something that hasn't worked? Your book seems to indicate that it's worked pretty well in other countries before ours even.
Yes, absolutely. And I think a lot of the resistance to it over the last few years has been from that mischaracterization of it as something where people who come here just have to give everything up and become like white Anglo-Saxon people, and that just isn't the case. When you step back and look at American culture, it incorporates the elements from so many different groups, from black people, from Hispanic, you name it. It's all there when you really look at it. And that was never more apparent to me than when I lived in England for a while. You could see that particularly the Native American and black traditions in the United States really set us apart from other Anglo groups, and they form part of our culture. Now, we've seen in the past how that same paradigm that I think has worked really well for America has worked in other places, some that you wouldn't expect. So, for example, the early Roman Empire, for all of its faults, brought together black people, people from Britain, Pannonians, Gauls, Thracians, all these different groups, and allowed them to become Roman and enjoy this shared sense of Romanitas, of Roman identity. And it made the Roman Empire just tremendously resilient, because you had people from all over the Mediterranean who thought they were on the Roman team. And so when outsiders attacked Rome, or when there's internal dissension, any kind of problems, Rome was able to surmount those because so many people felt that they were Romans, and they were willing to sacrifice for Rome.
One reason that Rome officially fell is that the Romans, who had previously welcomed the barbarians of many different groups into the possibility of becoming Roman citizens and all that that enthralled, got tired of it and just said, oh, no, they're, you know, if they're half barbarian, they're always going to be barbarian, and we're tired of messing with them. This begins to happen in about the 3rd century A.D., and by the 4th century, the whole melting pot concept has been pretty much thrown away. And frankly, it sounds an awful lot like multiculturalism. The Vandals did this, and the Goths did that, and the Alaric and his group were allowed to live in a certain way, and they were never going to be considered true Romans by the old elite, and on and on and on. And all sorts of people whose groups I'd never heard of were just kind of tolerated by the upper class in Rome. And it led to, as you can imagine, people being dissatisfied and saying, well, if we can't be Romans, then why do we need Rome at all? That's how they ended up sacking Rome and taking off as much as they could haul off. They had no loyalty to Rome. The melting pot was working great until the people, for whatever reason, who were in charge, said, we're tired of it now. We're not going to do this anymore. And that led pretty quickly to the destruction of the Roman Empire.
That's precisely right. And, you know, we can see when we look back at the Roman legions, you know, in the first century A.D., how they just brought in people from all over the place. There's one figure I talk about in the book, Lucius Quietus.
Yes.
He's a black African guy who started in the legion, was Romanized, made a Roman citizen, and before you knew it, he was a general, and eventually he rose to the consulship, which is like becoming president, and after that, he was a provincial governor. So there were countless figures like this who would otherwise be called barbarians, who Romanized and became part of the Roman team, and it just, even as the old Roman families kind of faded, These new people gave energy to Rome and, you know, shared this Roman team membership that was so powerful. And then, as you said, you get into the 4th century, and that model was abandoned. So these people who were formerly integrated into the Roman legions, instead, in particular, the Goths were kept separate as individual units with their own leaders that they were loyal to, instead of being integrated into the Roman system. So what you had in the 4th and 5th century was basically identity politics. Instead of a bunch of people becoming Roman, you had Group A, Group B, Group C, all kind of pitted against each other and against Rome. And yes, it absolutely has echoes with modern America, where again we're going into this model of siloing groups so that they're separate and kind of mutually inimical towards each other.
It's really sad that in this time and in this place, it seems like the melting pot is being considered old hat, and multiculturalism is being considered the new thing. Much as communism was once considered to be the new thing. And look how well that's turned out. Because America is unique in that our English lexicon has 500,000 words. And the reason it has so many words is that we have something like 30 different major language groups that feed a significant number of words into English. They've been adapted into English. And Brazil has done the same thing in the years past. Brazilian Portuguese is very different than the language spoken by the people in Portugal.
Absolutely. And, you know, that is one of the great strengths and virtues of the United States is that we have managed to incorporate the contributions of so many different cultures and meld them into the sort of unified whole that brings together all these different strengths. It's interesting with multiculturalism how it's kind of stated as a new thing. Well, you know, there's nothing new under the sun. Multiculturalism, as the book shows, has been done in the past many times. Most people don't like to think about the consequences of that, though.
And we're, in case you're just joining us, by the way, we are talking to Jens Heike, who's the author of Out of the Melting Pot, Into the Fire, Multiculturalism in the World's Past and America's Future. It's from Encounter Books, and you can check their website at encounterbooks.com. And they also are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Very interested to find out what's been going on in various parts of the world, in particular in Rwanda, because I remember not too long ago that there were terrible intertribal fighting and incredible atrocities and a genocide in Rwanda. You have researched this and found out that they have since turned things around by changing the attitude of the people and this very thing that we're talking about here. Instead of being multicultural, they said, nope, we're all Rwandans. Tell us what you found out in Rwanda.
Yeah, so Rwanda is really an amazing story. The genocide that you mentioned, it killed a million people. And this is out of a country that has 7 million people. So in proportional terms, that's like 47 million Americans being killed.
Right.
And it happened in 100 days. And if you could imagine, this wasn't like the Nazis and the Holocaust where they had Zyklon B gas and machine guns and so on. Most of those killings were carried out with farm implements and machetes. It was just a terrible thing. What a lot of people don't know is the origins of that genocide. They're very curious. And if you go back 100 years before, 150 years actually, before the Belgian colonialists arrived in Rwanda, the two groups, the Hutus and Tutsis, actually got along pretty well. There was no systematic violence between those two groups. But what happened is the Belgians, they showed up, and they kind of thought a divide-and-conquer approach would work better to administer the population. So they saw the two groups, and they said, we're gonna separate them. And they issued identity cards that either said you were Hutu or you were Tutsi. And to top it off, they implemented a sort of affirmative action where they favored the Tutsis over the Hutus. And as you can imagine, those two measures, giving the identity cards and then giving preference to one group over the other, did as it always does in history. It pitted the groups against each other.
Wow. And they did the same thing in the Congo, the Belgians did, didn't they? Invented conflict between indigenous tribes in order to divide them so that they'd be invited to stay and help out.
Yes. One of the things I come to over and over in my book is the mere identification of people, the separating of them into groups by itself can inspire antagonism. It's kind of the way humans are built. We're tribal animals. So when you divide people, this animosity almost arises spontaneously. And if you poison that division with some kind of preferences to favor one group or over another, it makes it all the worse. So that's what happened in Rwanda. For a long time, the Hutus were discriminated against, and then we got to independence, and they kind of flipped it on its head. So then we had three decades of the Hutus discriminating against the Tutsis. And that led to greater and greater animosity and eventually to the genocide. So the new Rwandan government, after the genocide happened, they came in and they looked back at history and said, we are not doing this anymore. So on day one, pretty much, they said, from now on, there are no Hutus, there are no Tutsis, we're all Rwandans. And they literally passed laws that absolutely forbade distinguishing people by group. And to this day, that's a very important thing there. Now, I talked with a few expatriate businessmen who do business there in Rwanda, and one of the things they told me is that when they get job applications, everything that indicates tribe, race, ethnicity, all of that, it's all blacked out. The people's names are even blacked out, so you don't know what gender they are. So they get these applications, and all they can look at is people's qualifications.
Wow.
And that pervades Rwanda today. They have this important sense that there are no groups. We are all Rwandans. And they've bolstered that with a number of different measures, which I talk about in the group. And it's gotten to the point where, you know, 95% of the country said they would rather die than distinguish and discriminate against others by group. They would give their lives rather than participate in ethnic division.
Wow. That is powerful.
It is. And, you know, this is a country that, you know, after the genocide happened, it was dead last in the world in terms of living standards, you name it. It was mm-hmm. dead last. And now you go to Kigali, the capital of Rwanda, and, you know, when I was there, I was amazed. It was like Zurich, Switzerland, or Singapore. You could eat off the streets. It was so tidy, and it is not only the safest place in Africa, but safer than a lot of European countries. It's the transition has just been incredible, and it's all been founded on this notion that we're all together. We're all one group of Rwandans. We're not Hutus. We're not Tutsis. We're not white. We're not black. We're one group.
Botswana has also apparently been able to embrace this more of a melting pot than they had previously been following, according to your book as well, right?
Yeah, so that's another fine example, and that one, it all really started with this curious situation where the king-to-be, back right after World War II, in 1948, he was in England studying, and he ended up falling in love and marrying a white British woman, which was hugely controversial at the time. In fact, the South African government, the English government, all sorts of people tried to prevent that marriage from happening, and they were actually really horrible to this young king-to-be and tried to deny him his kingship and so on because he was married to this white woman. And that experience spurred him and his country, Botswana, which he later became president of, to take another direction. He literally said, you know, we've seen racism in South Africa and racism in England, the results of distinguishing people, you know, by the group they were born into and how bad that is. So he said, in Botswana, we're not going to do that. So in their constitution, it absolutely forbids any sort of racial or ethnic distinction whatsoever. So much to the point that when I visited there, I wanted to do research. I wanted to find out statistics about black and white people there and the different groups. And I communicated with several government officials, and none of them could provide me with those statistics. They said, we don't keep them. We're not allowed to keep them.
There is, sadly, the exact reverse situation in what was once called Ceylon, a beautiful island off the Indian coast, now known as Sri Lanka, ever since World War II, I think. As you colorfully put it in your book, went from serendipity to calamity in just a few short decades. Was it abandoning a melting pot, or was there ever one there? And they certainly went to multiculturalism, and it did not turn out well from them, right?
Exactly. And they didn't exactly have a melting pot before. They had two main groups, the Tamils and the Sinhalese, who got along actually very, very well for hundreds of years. And in fact, when the country gained independence, the British governor said, this country is the best bet in Asia. It's going to do better than any of the other countries. Well, that turned out not to be the case, because a few years after independence, a politician looked at the two groups and he saw that there was a disparity of outcomes. The Tamils were generally wealthier and better educated than the Sinhalese. So he said, we have to adjust that. So what did they do? They started passing quotas for both employment and education. And what those quotas did is they gave both groups the sense that it's a zero-sum game. The only way we're going to get ahead is at the expense of the other group. And, you know, this is a pattern that repeats over and over in history. You know, you make it clear that they're two different groups and their interests are at odd, and the next thing you know, you have fighting, animosity, and genocide. Go ahead.
Oh, no. You finish.
So, and you know, that it's precisely what happened in Sri Lanka. This is a country that in 1960, it had the same per capita GDP as Korea. They were doing really well, and they were projected to do even better. Well, after they introduced these identity politics to the country, dividing the country into groups, they did not do well at all. In fact, again, I said they were on par with South Korea in 1960. Well, today, their per capita income is like a tenth of what South Korea's is.
Mm. There is another example that you have closer to home, but several hundred years back into history, of how the conquistadors were able to come in with a handful of men, defeat the Aztecs.
You know, I go through in the book each of those causes that past historians have attributed the collapse of the Aztecs to. For example, that they considered that Cortez and the Spanish were gods. Well, I completely debunk that and show how that was not the case at all, and kind of march through all those reasons. And what we ultimately come down to is that the Aztec Empire was like a pyramid built out of marbles. All it really took was a tiny nudge to set the whole thing falling apart. And that's because they, as opposed to the Romans, who made a point of uniting all these different groups under a shared identity, the Aztecs kept groups siloed and separate. I'm sure this may sound familiar to you, right?
Yeah.
They kept them separate and at odds with each other. So all it took was kind of a seed crystal, which Cortez was, to set the whole thing flying apart. And before you knew it, the core group of within the Aztec Empire, it was a group called the Mexica Tenochca, were the only ones really standing in the end against Cortez. All the other groups had either fled or were actually working against them. So here's Cortez. He's only got 500 guys. He's in theory arrayed against an empire with you know 200,000-300,000 people. You know, 500 against several hundred thousand. I, no matter what the technological difference is, those are impossible odds. Yet he won because the Aztecs were so riven with identity separation, identity politics, that they were just terribly weak.
The lesson for us is pretty obvious, that the people that are pushing multiculturalism either have not studied history, which there seems to be fewer and fewer people that actually study any kind of history other than that which they can remember as adults, that happened in their own lifetime. And because of that, they're embracing ideas that have not only potentially failed, but have been massive failures in past history, and instead throwing out the situations or the cultural situations like the melting pot that have been wildly successful in ancient history forward. So what do we do about that? I'm sure that's one of the reasons that you wrote the book.
That is correct. I'm hoping to change the minds as people, you know, are shown all this past history anew. They hopefully will begin to understand what a wonderful thing we've had in this melting pot model that we followed for so many years, and how just dangerous it is to abandon that to identity politics. You know, I think part of the reason for the resistance or the desire to throw out the melting pot is that it hasn't been perfect. Obviously, black people, for example, were excluded and horribly treated throughout much of U.S. history. But the answer to that is not to discard the model, the melting pot model, because that model is successful. The shortcoming was in not bringing all the groups like the blacks into it as we should have all these years.
Jens, it is a fascinating book, and I've read a lot about the Roman Empire, including that book that I read recently that talked about the fall of the major portion of the empire in the 4th and 5th century. And never anywhere did it really say, oh, and by the way, you know, the Romans made everybody feel welcome up to this point, and that's why things got screwed up. But when I read your book, and based on what I had learned from the other one, put it together with what you put forth in Out of the Melting Pot into the Fire, I realized, oh my gosh, that's exactly what happened. They went from being a place that everybody wanted to be a Roman citizen. Even Paul made a point of saying when he was being arrested or being about to be beaten or something, he'd say, but you know, I'm a Roman citizen. And people had to back off in the first century. But they sadly forgot all of their own history a couple of hundred years later and just kind of hunkered down in their little enclaves and basically let all of the warring tribes of Europe fight against each other rather than fighting for them.
Exactly. You know, don't get me wrong. The Romans did a lot of, they were by no means perfect. But
oh, sure.
They did get that one thing very right. Yeah. You know, they had all kinds of, you know, gladiatorial games and nasty other stuff, but that idea of uniting people that way and avoiding identity politics was just very, very powerful for them and made them tremendously successful. The Roman Empire, the western half of it lasted 1,000 years.
Yeah.
If you include the eastern half, it's 2,000 years.
Seems like that's a pretty good model to embrace, and particularly if you can do it better. And even with all the things we've done wrong, we've done it better than the Romans, so we can continue to tweak it instead of abandoning it. I think that's your book makes that painfully clear for all of its seeming like a compassionate idea that multiculturalism basically plants seeds that will someday produce a better harvest. Is there anything else that you had hoped that I'd ask you about that I have not, or anything else that you want to share with us before we go?
No, I think we pretty much covered it. I do hope that the book will alert some people to the course we're headed on right now and what the consequences of that could be.
Well, it's absolutely fascinating, Jens, and I encourage people, if you're at all interested in the history of, say, the future of our country, then it behooves you to get a copy of the book. It's not a 500-page tome. It is a relatively easy book to read for, even though Jens is a scholar, he wrote it in such a way that it's very readable. There's not tons and tons of statistics. If you want them, they're in the back of the book. But if you just want a narrative, the narratives are powerful. Thank you again so much for taking time to visit with us. Thank you for writing this book. I think it is really an eye-opener. I certainly hope it will become one that people read and talk about and gain insight from reading it. So,
thank you, Doc. Really appreciate it.
Our thanks again to Jens Heike. His that's how his name is pronounced. It's spelled JensHeyke, who is the author of Out of the Melting Pot, Into the Fire, Multiculturalism in the World's Past and America's Future. It's from Encounter Books. You can check their website, encounterbooks.com. Thanks so much for joining us today. Next week, we've got another wonderful author who will be with us, so please tune in at the same time on your favorite radio station, and also check out our podcast on thebookshelf.podbean.com that you can go back and listen to the interviews whenever you want. Until next time, I'm your host, Dave Doc Kirby. Thanks for listening, and God bless.